Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. Paul Bucock.
What's that?
Wait, let's give the audience about 10 seconds to make whatever jokes they want about your last name.
And whatever ones that they've come up with.
You've heard them.
Maybe. But once in a while there's something new, so please let them make their jokes. I enjoy them as much as the next guy. You get used to it.
You must have had fun with women on Halloween. I mean, that's the one that first comes to mind.
Halloween. But in a certain level, when your name is Bucock, every day is Halloween.
Oh, okay. Well, every day is Halloween with us here on Dave's Gone By with our guest Paul Bucock, and it is B-O-O-C-O-C-K. And the reason we have him as our guest tonight is that he's got an off-Broadway show playing at the Flea Theater on White Street downtown, opening June 30th, the very end of June.
Exactly.
And it's running, what's the run on this?
It's every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. But to keep it simple, think of July and think that every Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night, you can go see Bucock's House of Baseball at 9 p.m. at the Flea Theater.
Now, why would people want to see Bucock's House of Baseball?
Because it's called Bucock's House of Baseball, but it's about everything that's going on in this world right now.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished in the fall doing this show called Bucock Equals VP with this wonderful director that I'm still working with, named Mary Catherine Burke, and that show was about me running for Vice President of the United States of America. And it'd be, you know, in a political year, a politically polarized year, and I decided that I was, you know, just as suited to have the second highest position in the land as anyone else, and I was getting very depressed, and here comes the revelation of my political bent, at the idea that George Bush might get reelected president.
Gee, I can't imagine such a thing.
Yeah. But anyway, well, that's my political bent.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into a conversation, me and the director, about, okay, well, what if this guy gets reelected? What is left in this country that will keep us in this country?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think baseball is about the only thing. But then I sort of, you know, I thought about that and I said, well, baseball is not a bad thing to keep you in this country, because baseball still sort of, I'm not even going to say sort of, I said baseball still represents, I would think, all the great things about this country. And what I'm saying here in Bucock's House of Baseball is that all the great qualities of democracy are sort of inherently in baseball.
Well, how do you mean?
It's a team sport. I mean, I'm almost quoting David Mamet from The Untouchables. It's a team sport that demands a team attitude, but moments of individual achievement, as David Mamet says.
Mm-hmm.
But those moments of individual achievement have to be on behalf of the whole, on behalf of the entire body politic. Individual achievement just for the sake of me, I, my, is meaningless in a democracy, and meaningless in baseball. What comes to mind here is there are certain baseball players, and I think anybody who's a baseball fan sort of has this list in their mind of players who do well statistically, who rack up big numbers, big home run numbers, big runs batted in numbers, but somehow their individual achievements statistically don't translate into winning baseball. Don't translate into contribution to the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the show, I talk a lot about who the players are that are out there that personify that philosophy of a contribution to the whole.
Well, who would we be talking about? Mike Piazza in his prime, or
Mike Piazza
Hernandez?
In his prime, the one I come back to over and over again. I know it's the most obvious one in the book these days, because he's sort of known for his intangibles, is Derek Jeter.
Right, yeah.
He always seems to be at the right place at the right time when something absolutely must be done to win the game. And this doesn't, you know, say that he doesn't year after year end up putting up big numbers. He does. I mean, he's, you know, by any statistical measurement, the guy's going to make it to the Hall of Fame. But his hits seem to matter more than the hits of other people, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want.
Well, isn't that as much the media creation as his own persona and his own quality?
Well, I think something there's something that starts to happen that's circular there. You know, I think to myself that Derek Jeter is probably a guy who showed up in this game with a decent level of self-esteem. He then did come through in the clutch at times, and then people reinforced the idea that he was that kind of player, and now he plays with the sort of relaxed attitude that you need in order to keep coming through in the clutch. The Yankees, of course, have this other player now, A-Rod, getting paid more than anybody else to play the game, and he seems to not be that kind of guy, and that seems to then become a reinforced idea, perhaps even in his own mind.
But how does this become a theatrical equivalent that is not only political, but mm-hmm. You put it on stage and it becomes interesting solo drama?
Right. Well, I perform great moments in baseball as sort of a docudrama of moments, of great moments.
How do you mean?
Well, there's a very famous play that folks who are baseball fans know about. A couple of years ago, Derek Jeter made a play in a playoff game where he ran across the entire infield, not a play in any playbook, caught a ball that was thrown wildly from the outfield, and then pushed the ball to the catcher, who then made a tag, and it sort of then started a momentum for the Yankees. And I do a section of the show where I describe that moment and do it while I'm describing it. And then channel that into conversation about what that moment meant to New York City right after what we call the events of 9/11. That there was something that happened sort of from that moment on where he pulled together an entire city and then an entire country that not even normally inclined to be supportive of anything New York necessarily.
Especially the Yankees. Yeah.
Especially the Yankees who personify in many ways, who even personify in many ways some of the things that I don't like about an increasingly corporatized entertainment industry. But in a certain moment, he did seem to dig down for something deeper that inspired people and kept people involved and believing that there was a reason to get up the next day and see the next game to see how this drama played itself out.
Well, it isn't new to see baseball as a metaphor for all sorts of life things, all the way back to Casey at the bat.
Sure.
Was quite metaphorical. But, I mean, you could just as easily see baseball as embodying a lot of the negative stereotypes of what happens in America or any country.
I get into that, too. In many ways, what I'm saying in this show is that you can always look at baseball, and it can embody some of the great things about America, but it is a way of looking at the truth of America now. And that was another thing that my director and I started to discuss and that is now bleeding into this show, the idea that in an increasingly corporatized media where you can't necessarily get the truth about what's going on in this world, particularly in this country, if you go to the back pages, if you go to the sports pages, things are a little less censored or self-censored about the information about what happens to these ball players, and there is information in that about what's really going on. The steroid scandals I get into a little bit.
Exactly, yeah.
And, there's information that you can get from that.
I mean, like, in our news right now is the revelation of who was Deep Throat for Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
The fact they had to be so secretive in a parking lot for this to be dug up and come out, and it was dangerous. Meanwhile, in baseball, steroids were this almost laughable open secret that a guy basically wrote a book about to make money on. And then even then it was tough to get hearings going.
Well, I mean, but on a certain level, I think that was even the case with Watergate. I mean, it's interesting because what you just said was something it hit me that way too. And I went back to the source material, All the President's Men, and that's the movie, not the book. So I'll say that up front. But watching that, I started to realize this was a story that was sort of there for the taking for a long time, and it took a lot of hammering at it. and a lot of repeating that these guys were doing the bad thing. And if you looked at Richard Nixon's track record for his entire career, he was doing things that were, at the very least, borderline unethical.
Although probably no worse than Lyndon Johnson had done in his term.
Granted, on a certain level, it's unfair for me to pick out Nixon more than LBJ or any of the guys. But if you looked at Nixon's career, there was a pattern. And yet it took, a little bit of hammering. You keep hammering at it, Even there are great scenes in that movie where the folks working on the newspaper itself are like, why are we sticking with this story? Ben Bradley was like, where's the story? Where's the story? I'm not seeing the sources yet. And yet, eventually, the democratic process, or at least the checks and balances of a media watching the democratic process and reporting the truth of the democratic process, did catch up to Nixon.
But what happened in the steroid scandal is that the democratic process sort of caught up and nobody cared.
Yeah,
people don't even know if they think steroids are wrong, let alone, they're wrong for your body, but whether it's wrong to even take people out of the Hall of Fame or wrong for them to use them, because how different is it from somebody who's doing special vitamins?
Or, no, I know. A lot of people talked about a lot of the ball players who've had things done to their eyes. Laser surgery. What's the difference between Greg Maddux and Bernie Williams having laser surgery, which is ultimately sort of a radical maneuver with the original equipment you were given, and sticking in 10 cc's of testosterone in your butt cheeks. Maybe it's not that different.
I wouldn't know either way.
Me neither.
Hey, by the way, let's just backtrack a little bit. Before you started doing Bukak's House of Baseball, you were doing, you were part of comedy improv sketch troupes.
Yeah, the one that I did for the longest stretch of time was something called Premium Bob, which was a two-person comedy team that for a pretty substantial stretch of time back there in the 90s, was a cult New York hit, and we even eventually we got out to the other coast and had our TV deal, and it came and it went.
Yeah, what happens? What happens in those cases? You work on. I mean, you were also part of Elevator Repair Service.
I still do some work with them from time to time, and that's a great team to be a part of. Those guys are fantastic.
But what happens? I mean, I guess there's a shelf life unless you hit it really big. Is that the thing where you're young and you're with a group?
You gotta. I mean, there's a shelf life, and after my experiences with particularly with the Premium Bob thing, it started to make me realize that a lot of things have to work in your favor for you to make it big. You know, it's like on a certain level, there's so many ways for things to not get to that level that when they do, it's just some luck on top of some luck, and then you got to have some luck on top of that too.
And then if it doesn't happen, it makes more sense to sort of stop and go off and do something else, not like start it back at the middle of the hill and try with the same people.
I think on a certain level, you can't do that. I think the business itself wishes that you could just bottle what talents folks have and just bottle it and be able to just produce it as product. But in the natural order of things is for things to evolve, and if they don't evolve to another place where there's growth and then usually things they naturally come to an end.
How would you describe your style of comedy, of what you do when you are on stage?
It's very physical stuff. I mean, it's almost dance at times. I guess what I mean when I say dance, not so much like modern or jazz or ballet, but like dance in the way that physical comedians of even the silent era are dancers. There's sort of elements of mime. Would you call it dumb show?
Well, also I think W.C. Field called Charlie Chaplin, quote, a goddamn ballet dancer.
Yeah,
which he meant as sort of an insult, but I think even he knew that. No, it was a beauty and a comedy
yeah.
to what he was doing.
Yeah, the elevator repair service folks I work with did a lot of that. And Premium Bob, we did a lot of that, too. And I think that's still, in so many ways, that's the stuff that always works. You can be topical, and in the show I'm doing right now, there's a lot of topical stuff. But the bits that people are going to remember, I think, past, oh, yeah, I agree with that. Okay, I disagree with what that guy just said. The stuff they're going to remember, regardless of their opinions, is the physical stuff.
And speaking of physical stuff, there was a mention made, and I wasn't too clear on this from the publicity folks, but are you a photographer, or you were photographed on some level by someone?
At the peak of Premium Bob?
Mm-hmm.
Things were hot enough for us that when the New Yorker did an issue about what New York was in 1999, they got Richard Avedon, who was, I think, their main sort of high-end staff photographer, and we got a photo taken of us with a bunch of other of the sort of downtown, the important downtown artists there. So there's a great picture of us that I still have. That I look at to remind myself that I have some worth.
Was that an amazing experience?
Was great.
Was it an all-day thing, or was he quick and within an hour you were out of it?
I mean, this is a guy, and I think this is true of so many people who are artists, even ones whose work has sort of an immediacy that says, oh, well, they just caught a moment. There's a lot of planning that goes into that. It was Richard Foreman, the guy from Hedwig.
Oh, wow.
And,
John Cameron Mitchell?
I think it was exactly.
Or Einstein and Trask.
It was Mitchell.
Yeah.
Uta Hagen and Amy Sedaris. And when he took the photo, it was taken in a subway car of the sort of 60s, 70s, early 80s era when there was lots of work on it, lots of graffiti art on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he posed us sort of in the middle of the car in various poses. I'm hovering over Amy Sedaris as if I'm gonna eat her prosthetic leg. my partner David Latham is swinging through an open window on the side. But he did it piece by piece. He took a Polaroid of each of the people in the photo, and then took those Polaroids. I watched him do this. And assembled the Polaroids to see if ahead of time each of the images he'd captured from each individual person in the photo was going to work. And then he took the picture, and it took half a day to assemble just that one shot.
You think that's for real, or that's just an exclusive why they would pay him thousands and thousands of dollars? You know, so I have to look like I'm really puzzling this out.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So let me take a few Polaroids that are, you know, like 30 cents a piece, and that'll make me look like I'm really earning my money.
You are more cynical than I am.
Oh, totally, dude.
I don't know. I think that's, you know, there may be some photographers who just like, you know, thank you, man. But I think that's legitimately his problem.
I know. But you know, you don't see baseball photographers who snap that amazing or sports photographers catching, the player an hour beforehand, having go up to the basket and say, well, if you make the shot from here,
yeah.
and get the fingertips just
looking
like that.
Yeah, you
gotta
roll it just off that finger, the middle fingernail would be best. Yeah.
No, they just sort of grab it, and sometimes they get really, really lucky. But I'm very lucky to have had you as a guest on this episode of Dave's Gone By. Last question.
Sure.
You're doing Bukak's House of Baseball. Mm-hmm. What are you working on while that's going on, or what do you plan afterwards?
Oh my gosh, well, there are a couple things sort of happening. I have a role on a Cartoon Network show called The Venture Brothers, which is a sort of knockoff of Johnny Quest, but for an adult audience. And I did some voice work with that. The two main guys in that are James Urbaniak, and I'm going to forget his name. Forgot it.
Urbaniak is part of that whole downtown scene.
He's part of that whole scene.
Yeah.
They put a bunch of those shows together in 2003, 2004, and it just got picked up again. So hopefully I get some more work on that. And I don't know. I'm not entirely sure what the next Bukak show is going to be. It probably will still have some baseball in it. Almost all my shows have some baseball elements in it. But I'm thinking sort of more and more about something that it has almost no no language at all. It's almost purely physical, and I'm not sure what it's going to be. But you know, as I've been working on this thing, I've been falling more and more for the stuff that is the purely physical stuff. So I do like to roll the monosyllabic, the polysyllabics off my lips too. But we'll see. There's a variety of things.
Well, polysyllabically, I want to thank Paul Bukock, B-O-O-C-O-C-K, for joining us on Dave's Gone By. Please remember that his show, Bukock's House of Baseball, is playing at the Flea Theater.
It opens June 30th through the 23rd of July, and we'll see what happens in terms of, we'll see what happens after that.
We'll see if it's a hit, a home run, or a grand slam.
There you go. A solid single up the middle would make me plenty happy.
That'd be great. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us in the neighborhood.
You bet.